Some of the more incredible folks here today are Chicagoans who have been personally affected by gun violence. And these are either survivors or families who have not only survived the trauma of gun violence, but have actually turned their pain into purpose, if I can borrow a line, and they're committed to making things better so that fewer families have to deal with what they've had to deal with. And feel that pain that they've had to hold and carry. So thank you for that commitment. Thank you for your advocacy, and thank you for turning that pain and that grief into purpose and advocacy. It's very much appreciated. You all are doing your part. City Club is committed to doing our part, which is sharing this platform. We are partnering with the Joyce Foundation, in fact, and we're going to be, over the next several months, we're going to be hosting a number of events, a series, actually, that we're going to call Ending Gun Violence in Chicago. How about that? Ending Gun Violence in Chicago. Connecting policy, practice, and community. We've got some big, bold ideas. We are going to do our part and share that. Those conversations here. We hope that you'll join us next week. Actually, our first program is called The Ecosystem of Public Safety. It's on Thursday, a week from today, at the Home and Square Community Center. So please join us for that. Pain Over Purpose, as I mentioned, the co-founder, Pam Montgomery Bosley, is here. Pam's going to be speaking at that, along with the Joyce Foundation's Tim Daly and the Civic Committee's Eric Smith. From BMO. So to join us for that, please head to our website or check in on the way out. It's going to be another great program. But today's program is really an incredible group of leaders, and we're going to be hearing from the state's leaders on the impact of gun safety laws. But to introduce our panel today, we have a special guest joining us. She is the founder of the Blair Holtz Peace Alliance and co-founder of Pain Over Purpose, along with Pam at St. Sabina. She also has a day job putting out fires that keeps her pretty busy. So please join me in welcoming a great civic leader, Annette Nance Holtz. Thank you, Annette.
Yeah. Good afternoon. Thank you, Dan. I'm so pleased to be here to open today's program on a subject matter that our government has finally recognized as a public health crisis that it is. I commend the Biden administration and the U.S. Surgeon General for recognizing that we in Chicago have been experiencing for far too long. For me, the issue is incredibly personal after gun violence took the life of my only child, Blair Holt. It has been 17 years since my son was murdered on a CTA bus, and I think about him every day. It is an agonizing wound that will never heal. Just like many other bystanders who simply are trying to go about their day in Chicago, Blair was riding a bus coming home from Percy O. Julian High School when a gang member came aboard and began indiscriminately firing at a rival gang member. Blair was an honor student at Percy Julian. He died shielding a friend from the bullets that ultimately took his life. Also, four others were wounded that day. They survived, but they will be traumatically impacted for life. That's what gun violence does. It impacts us for life. Blair had his entire life ahead of him before he, at 16 years old, chose to risk himself for a fellow classmate. His heroism on that tragic day is why I have chosen to fight every day since to put an end to senseless gun violence. Since losing Blair, I helped start the organization Purpose Over Pain, and Pam Bosley is here, one of the co-founders, to support other parents who've lost children to gun violence. And his dad and I created the Blair Holt Foundation to provide scholarships to high school students in his name. Blair loved education, and he knew it was the only way to change this. I've also fought for meaningful change with other survivors working to pass the Cook County assault weapon ban over a decade ago. It was named after Blair Holt originally, and being among the proud supporters and leaders of the movement to expand that ban, that statewide ban last year. There is no doubt that these laws will make a difference, but there is so much more work to be done, and to help other parents raise their families in a world that seems more concerned about the rights of gun owners than the safety of innocent children. And let me just say, any person that's lost a loved one to gun violence, raise your hand. Look at this room. Look at this room. Thank you. I'm proud to live in a city and a state where we see public officials' commitment to our cause across government. And I thank them for their work. Thank you so much for standing with survivors of gun violence, because it means so much to us. We can't do it. Though I will never get Blair back, I continue to dedicate my life to creating a better and safer city in his memory. He would want me to do that. And I hope you all will, too. So thank you. And I want to thank the City Club again for inviting me here to share a few words. I want to now welcome to the stage our panelists today, who are all dedicated champions of our mission. So, Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul. Senate President Don Harmon. Illinois State Police Director Brendan Kelly. And GPAC President and CEO Kathleen Sances. Please join us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon.
Annette, I want to thank you for your determination in the face of such immense loss. I'm inspired by your courage and your persistence and our long friendship, and I love you so much. Thank you. I want to thank the City Club today for putting together this impressive panel. I am honored to moderate the discussion. Each of these distinguished guests has been a champion in fighting to end gun violence in our state, and we're anxious to hear about this important work in a moment. Just a few weeks ago, as Annette mentioned, the Surgeon General declared gun violence a public health crisis. 2 weeks ago in Chicago, during the July 4th week and weekend, we experienced two mass shootings and several incidents of gun violence, claiming 19 lives and wounding 100, over 100. And of course, over this last weekend, there was a deadly shooting at a Trump rally in Pennsylvania that shocked the world. It injured a former president, claimed the life of an innocent man. And immediately after the shooting, there were cries for let's end political violence. But our problem reaches far beyond politics, especially in communities of color and communities that have been historically disinvested. Gun violence is the number one cause of death for our children. So let's call for an end to all violence. We know that addressing the epidemic of gun violence requires many solutions. One critical piece of the work that Dan mentioned is community violence intervention. These are frontline organizations doing the work in vulnerable communities to stop the violence before it even starts. So let's all be a part of that discussion next week and support those efforts and make sure that they're invested in so that they continue to have the positive effect that they are. But today we're here to talk about a separate piece of our efforts, how enacting common sense gun safety laws can reduce the number of guns on the streets, limit the availability of illegal weapons in our communities, and other solutions to this intractable problem. In Illinois, we should take a moment to recognize that due to the work and the efforts of so many people in this room, and the comprehensive approach that these leaders have taken to gun safety laws, we could have prevented Saturday shooting that happened in Pennsylvania. Because in Illinois, when you can buy a firearm, you have to go through a mandatory universal background check. And you are part of a robust licensing system to own that firearm. And in order to carry that firearm in public, you have to undergo 16 hours of training. And I'm proud to say that the gun that was used to carry out that shooting in Pennsylvania is no longer allowed. It is banned in this state because of the Protect Illinois Community Act. Another sign worth noting, a sign of progress, is that in Chicago from the years 2016 to 2023, the gun homicide per capita rate has decreased over 5%. And that's the trend we want to see. The gun rate homicide per capita is still much higher than we want, and it outpaces major cities like Los Angeles and New York. But the rate has dropped at the same time that many of the laws that we're here to talk about today were passed and took effect. Many of the organizations and committed stakeholders that we work to pass these reforms over the year are here today, and I just want to really recognize their work. One Aim Illinois is led by Yolanda Androzo. Yolanda leads the Illinois Gun Violence Prevention Coalition. The coalition is a grassroots coalition of over 200 groups, and it was launched 30 years ago today by Senator Dan Katowski. The coalition also includes important groups like Giffords, Brady United, and Moms Demand Action, also in our audience today. I want to acknowledge Tom Vandenberg, here he is, who courageously founded GPAC after gun violence took the life of his son, Tommy. Tom turned pain into purpose and developed GPAC so that there was finally a comprehensive political strategy to take on the gun lobby in Illinois, so that no other family would have to feel the pain that Tom did. Thank you, Tom. Finally, I would like to thank our Founder Circle members in the audience today, the individuals who fund this life-saving work, who know that elections have consequences, and we all know elections cost money. Please stand and be acknowledged. Bill and Maureen McInerney, Lucy S. Goley, Senator Dan Katowski, Mike Petting, and James Franzen. Our three panelists have been instrumental in this work, and I could go on about what great champions they are, but let me just simply say we wouldn't be here today without their leadership. I want to open the discussion today with each of you briefly talking about your work in this area, and we'll start with the Attorney General.
You say briefly?
I sure did.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you for having me here, and thanks for you acknowledge all of the people in the room who have worked in this movement to prevent the type of violence we've unfortunately seen, and it takes all of us. And there's people always ask the question, what can be done about gun violence, as if there's a single answer, and it's comprehensive. And that's the approach that I've taken as Attorney General from the outset of my tenure in 2019. I told my staff that we're going to establish, Kathy Hunt Muse from my office is here, she heads up an internal task force, and so we've broken down the silos within the office, and we have all heads put together to think on a month-to-month basis what can we do. And so some of those things have involved litigation. We sued to have a rogue gun manufacturer's license revoked. Obviously, we continue to be, people have misinterpreted the Supreme Court deny and cert as meaning that's a final answer on the assault weapons ban. But, you know, we continue to defend the assault weapons ban as it's been sent back to us to continue doing so. We advocated for the Firearm Industry Responsibility Act that clarifies that our Consumer Fraud Act protects against deceptive or harmful marketing towards children or other illegal organizations with regards to firearms. We've worked with law enforcement partners such as the ATF, State Police, Cook County Sheriff Leo Schmitz is here, on gun trafficking cases. And I had invited Christopher Amon as my special guest, but he's busy up in Milwaukee at some meeting they're having up there. I don't know what he's doing. But I have to say, since the beginning of my tenure as Attorney General, the ATF has enhanced their partnership, and Chris Amon has been really good at sort of changing, and I'm sure Director Kelly can talk about that, the extent to which they've invited law enforcement partners into their Crime Gun Intelligence Center, and we've successfully used it to prosecute gun traffickers. And partnering with Director Kelly, we've tried to develop a tool of our own, Crime Gun Connect, which we've invested into setting up a crime gun tracing platform. Shout out Chris Del Perez, because there are two sides to this, and we have a lot of survivors here. The trauma that is faced by survivors and those around them has to be addressed. And through our crime victim services, we've expanded our historical focus on domestic violence and sexual assault to really enhance our response to gun violence in the same way we've historically done with those two. And then our legislative team is here, so we've been active in the legislature as well. I couldn't do it briefly. I'm sorry.
Oh, it's pretty good. Pretty good. President Harmon?
Well, thank you all. I really appreciate the room recognizing the presence and power of survivors of gun violence, particularly moms. The activism of that community has really transformed the political debate. And I know some folks were recognized, but I want to shout out to, at our table, sitting with a good half of the Illinois Senate Democratic Caucus, is Bertha Purnell from the West Side, from my district. Kind of advisor who advises and holds you accountable, and this is something for which I'm grateful. When I was elected in 2002, in my first General Assembly in 2003, Mayor Daley came down to Springfield with a package of legislative initiatives. I was asked to introduce the gun dealer licensing bill, and coincidentally at the same time Senator Tony Munoz introduced the assault weapons ban. Now, this was when the Democrats had taken over the Senate for the first time in a decade. I'm sure that there had been efforts in the past, but you know, my life begins when I joined the Senate, so nothing happened before that. Needless to say, the bill didn't pass in my first General Assembly, and perhaps there was a little bit of a, you know, political gamesmanship involved in rolling out that package, but nobody told me, so I reintroduced it in the next General Assembly. And the next, and the next. And it never passed. It never got that critical momentum. It took 16 years. And finally, because of the engagement of survivors, because so much had happened to level the playing field, I was able to get that bill over the finish line. And, of course, Governor Rauner vetoed it. So all that work goes into passing a bill, and he sends it back saying, it's too much of this, it's too much of that. And I remember sitting in my office in the Capitol with my green marker and just taking the bill apart and rebuilding it and tightening it up and addressing all the concerns that were raised. And we were able to pass it again with a handful of Republican votes, which is the first time I've seen that happen in a long time. I tell that story not to flatter myself, but a couple of lessons that come from that. One, patience is a virtue. You have to stick with it, even when it seems impossible. Two, you need to be flexible. You need to recognize that your first proposal may not be the only way to accomplish the objective. And if you listen to the folks in the debate, there are ways to get to where we want to get by doing it differently. But really, what changed in Springfield, at least, was groups like GPAC, Moms Demand Action, Every Town. There was a real change after so many horrific incidents. We're all acutely aware of mass shootings, school shootings. They offend our sensibility. I remind people regularly that there's a mass shooting every weekend in the district I represent. It just doesn't always happen in the same corner at the same time. And we should treat these with the same moral equivalency. These are the same lives being lost. But we can't give up. We need to continue to marshal those resources. People of goodwill and common sense tend to agree on this. We just never had their power harnessed. And so to GPAC and to all the other organizations, thank you for finally harnessing common sense.
Thank you, President Harvin. Leaves you, Director Kelly.
Well, basic civics lesson. They write the laws and then we enforce them. We're part of the executive branch, the Illinois State Police. And I look back to where we were almost 6 years ago now, right after the mass shooting in Aurora, and I had just become a director of the Illinois State Police. And we had an extended period before that of budget instability. And that made it quite difficult for the state police to be able to staff, to plan, to have a long-term strategic thinking in terms of our Firearms Services Bureau. And we really have had to go through a transformation in terms of our focus, getting away from the bureaucracy of the FOID card and some of the other administrative procedures that are in place to a focus on how we're using those statutes and those policies to focus on safety, so moving from bureaucracy to safety. And in doing so, and in working with advocates from all different perspectives when it comes to firearms, we really have had at times to fight a two-front war. Because of that instability, we had a huge backlog in FOID card applications that had built up over the years. And again, those are lawful gun owners, in most cases, seeking to be able to exercise their rights. And it is our duty to make sure that's properly done. But we also had some major challenges in terms of the gap that was there in terms of a universal background check. And when that process on the FOID card side doesn't work well, that undermines support for very reasonable measures. And that made it more difficult to make the case in the legislature for some of these measures focused on gun safety. Well, we tackled that because we had the resources to do so. We had stable budgets. That was very much a priority for Governor Pritzker to make sure we had the resources we need to get that job done. And then we used our subject matter expertise to work with various groups, and again, on either side of this issue, to make sure that we were able to come to an agreed language for a universal background check, and making sure that every gun that is being transferred goes through that process. And it's a very obvious common thing, but the common sense thing, but the technicalities of it can be extremely difficult. We have to execute. We have to take these ideas and policies and these laws and make them real and enforce them. And we've had tremendous success on a number of fronts, not just the universal background check solution that we came up with, but also the tremendous progress we've made when it comes to clear and present danger, more enforcement of firearms restraining orders, getting resources to local law enforcement, not just the state police, to be able to enforce these laws. So the whole host of things that have become a reality and that we're doing on a daily basis. Just from June of last year to June of this year, Over 11,000 reports of clear and present dangers have been submitted to the Illinois State Police from local law enforcement, from schools, from mental health officials. And in reviewing those, 10,000 of those were founded. And that there was evidence, there was enough information to say that this person was a danger and met the threshold for the statute. And that resulted in thousands of revocations. That resulted in thousands of individuals being denied the ability to get a firearm. The firearms FTIP program, when someone tries to purchase a firearm, over 1,000 of those last year. So if you start to add those numbers up, just in a year time frame, the laws in the state of Illinois that are trying to protect people and trying to make sure that we don't put guns in the hands of people who shouldn't have them, that's over 25,000 times that we've done that just in the past year. So these things are real, they make a difference, and it just takes a lot of enforcement and effort.
Thank you. And I feel that we don't talk about that enough, about how many prohibited purchases that we're stopping with the background check paired with the licensing system. So I'm going to give you kind of a quick tutorial. We're talking about all these measures, but we've got some slides that we're going to share about the measures that we have passed in recent years. So the first thing that we were able to do was hold corrupt gun dealers accountable. We enacted universal background checks for every gun sale. We made untraceable homemade ghost guns illegal. Thank you, Leader Buckner.
Senator Jackie Collins is here, too.
Oh, Senator Collins. We also banned military-style weapons and high-capacity magazines. We are holding gun manufacturers accountable for the devastation that their products inflict on our communities. And we enacted a firearm restraining order to temporarily remove firearms when someone could be at risk of harming themselves or others. Our focus on these policies with leaders was not an accident. Every initiative we pursue is backed by evidence and research. We work closely with Johns Hopkins, which provided extensive research and evidence valuable for how to end gun violence in Illinois. We were also guided by the 2017 TRACE report written with the City of Chicago, the Chicago Police Department, and the University of Chicago Crime Lab. President Herman, I want to start with you. You've kind of covered this, but starting with the gun dealer licensing program and then moving forward to all these bills, can you talk about how many of the laws were passed because of robust advocacy programs?
Oh, without a doubt, the advocacy programs have transformed the political debate. When I started in the Senate, there was really only one voice on guns in Springfield, and that was the State Rifle Association, our local chapter of the NRA. Even though we knew that most everybody, an overwhelming majority would agree with our position, there was no one organizing the overwhelming majority, and that was a real disadvantage. There were attempts, but GPAC was one of the first to really harness that here in Illinois. There were understandable reactions to horrific shootings across the country that spurred Moms Demand Action and some of the other organizations. And that coalition here in Illinois really transformed the debate. I have colleagues here, Senator Laura Murphy, Senator Selena Villanueva, Senator Lakeisha Collins, who represent different parts of the state, but I think you would all join me in saying that having organized constituents demanding that we do something really emboldens legislators to take on something that seemed too difficult to do before that.
And do you think the power balance has changed?
Without a doubt. And in some surprising ways, I think it has tipped in our favor. The State Rifle Association is still a formidable organization. There are still members of the Senate Democratic Caucus who have constituencies that listen to them, and we can't forget that. That's part of the conversation. But more than anything, it's in the districts that really had nobody organizing that now have a robust base of constituents coming in and saying, you need to do something about it, and you need to do it now.
And do you think that there are some districts where we still have some work to do?
Absolutely. This is less a partisan issue than it is a geographic issue, an urban versus rural issue. The suburbs are looking more and more urban in their political demeanor. But my thinking on this has evolved over my time in Springfield. I grew up in Oak Park, a nuclear-free zone, as well as a handgun-free zone. We didn't see weapons growing up. If anyone saw a gun, something really bad was happening. You know, my colleagues from rural Illinois, they grew up with rifles in their homes. It was a tool. It's not something that they fear or think should be regulated the same way they might think an assault weapon should be regulated. We need to be more sophisticated and recognize that the actual distinction as well as the cultural distinction.
Right. Attorney General Ault, you've led the state's defense of Illinois' gun reforms against the gun rights movement, and I want to take a moment to say that on behalf of GPAC and especially John Schmidt, former Associate Attorney General, we want to extend our gratitude to your team for their exceptional work in defending the assault weapons ban.
Turn that way, not this way, because that's not true.
Honestly. We'd love to hear about those efforts, and maybe you can give us a little snapshot into what you think is going to happen next with that.
Yeah, so we're talking multiple things here. So first of all, there's PICA, the otherwise known as the assault weapons ban, that, you know, Director Kelly and I have something in common as being named as defendants. Something I've grown accustomed to as Attorney General is being a defendant. Again, as I mentioned earlier, while we were very happy that the Supreme Court denied cert to the sort of interlocutory appeals up, there's no indication there about what ultimately will happen at that level. Shout out Sarah Hunger, and who did a phenomenal job last year at defending these cases before the Seventh Circuit, and I was there as she participated in oral arguments and witnessing the panel toiling with the construct of Bruin, and I have to be careful because they'll throw something at me. I will get if I talk about the construct that Justice Thomas has said we have to now evaluate these Second Amendment claims. But so it's a two-part test. First of all, answering the question of whether the text of the Second Amendment protects these types of weapons. And if anything, that Butler, Pennsylvania from last week illustrates for us that AR-15s can have lethality from a long distance away, and that's not I don't think that's the vision of the framers back in the 18th century, that people were going to be walking around with AR-15s near schoolyards, presidential rallies, and places like that. That it's more of a weapon of war. And in the Seventh Circuit decision, as they evaluated, they were making comparison of AR-15s to M-16s. Based on how they can be adjusted with bump stocks. So the Seventh Circuit, not to get granular there, but the Seventh Circuit had to go through a decision making of the likelihood of prevailing in further proceedings, and said that the plaintiffs did not have a likelihood of prevailing on both ends of the test, whether it's a type of arm protected by the Second Amendment, and secondly, with this evaluation of whether the tradition of laws regulated arms is whether this is consistent with that. And on both of those points, they said the plaintiffs were not likely to prevail. We have to go back before Judge McGlynn in the Southern District, as well as we'll be back, you know, inevitably in the Seventh Circuit. So this journey is not over. But in the meantime, assault weapons are banned in the state of Illinois.
So, Director Kelly, I kind of gave a tutorial on this whole profile of gun safety legislation we passed. Is looking at it from an enforcement standpoint, how are we doing?
Well, I think we've made a lot of progress, and I think that is absolutely critical part of this. These things have to be real. They can't just be intent or, you know, words on a paper and the compiled statutes of Illinois somewhere. They have to be made real, and they are made real every day by the men and women who serve in law enforcement and who, frankly, every day are risking their lives to enforce these laws in some very dangerous situations. The firearms enforcement funding that is part of the fee that we collect through the FOID fee that goes to local law enforcement, they are using those funds, our local law enforcement partners, as well as the Illinois State Police, to go out there every day when someone has been identified because their FOID card has been revoked and they have a purchase history, and we know the reason that they have been revoked, and they present a great degree of danger through a variety of factors that we consider. Those are the cases that we are working up, and we are making sure that the firearms that we believe they have are properly disposed of, either with law enforcement or someone who can lawfully have them. We see an increasing number of local law enforcement that have applied for those state police funds that we have, and they're using them. You know, and again, this is not about a piece of plastic, a little card that you keep in your wallet. This is about someone who has clearly shown a threat to themselves or to others that likely has a firearm, and they have lost the lawful authority to have that firearm, and there has to be enforcement to make sure that, you know, that this is real. And it gets better every year. More and more individuals are being placed directly into compliance. More and more local enforcement is occurring. We've had to shift as an agency, and everybody knows the state troopers with the Montana P-Cats. You may have encountered them on the interstates from time to time, telling you to tap the brakes a little. We have, you know, probably or maybe worse. I don't know. That's your problem. But we've had to shift from a focus on traffic enforcement to trafficking enforcement. And that's the evolution of the state police in the 21st century and what we've been doing over the past 4 or 5 years. The gun trafficking, the human trafficking, the drug trafficking that is co-occurring. And that's where we are. Our men and women are proving their worth every day in terms of our role when it comes to firearms enforcement.
That's great. So I know time is ticking away, and we want to talk about what is next. We know there's still a lot of work to do, and so I want to also just focus on Springfield, what's going to happen. There is a recommendation in the Gun Trace report that I mentioned before that we should enhance reporting of lost and stolen firearms. GPAC is currently working and supporting an initiative to do that. You know, that will keep those guns from ending up in crime scenes. Related to that would be the safe storage of guns. If guns are stored safely, they won't be stolen and then, again, end up in crime scenes. In the secondary market, and also just as important for safe storage would be to curb suicide with guns and unintentional shootings. Can each of you take a minute to talk about some of these initiatives or other initiatives you think we need to consider moving forward?
Yeah, so sure. Lost and stolen,
East. I used the opportunity to shout out everybody I brought with me. So Caitlin McKellis sat as a Senate staffer with me years ago as we were negotiating the concealed carry bill that we were mandated to pass. And sort of the bargain there was to make sure that there was an element that required reporting of lost and stolen weapons. But as we've acknowledged, we couldn't at the time, because of the politics at the time, really put any teeth into that. And so, yeah, I would applaud any effort to put more teeth into the enforcement of non-reporting of lost and stolen weapons. As far as any other potential legislation or we've been working with law enforcement partners on reporting of crime gun trace data for Crime Gun Connect. The tool is a really neat tool that I think eventually will be used by law enforcement in a way to really crack down on gun trafficking and straw purchasers. But it's only as good as we have a full participation of law enforcement partners. So there's some discussion about how we may be able to sort of mandate that. But we've been doing our tour and talking to law enforcement partners, and that has led to a lot of, I think, over 200 law enforcement departments dumping their data. And again, it's a really neat, useful tool. We also get feedback from law enforcement partners as to how we can improve upon the tool to make it useful to individual law enforcement departments. Because at the end of the day, the type of mass shootings and day-to-day shootings that Senator Harmon referred to, which is unlike what we were talking about in Highland Park, because just a week after Highland Park, there was Washington Park. It didn't get much attention, but those guns, as opposed to what was used in Butler last week, are illegally sold in traffic. In most cases, they're not guns that are legally bought. So, cracking down on the trafficking, on the straw purchases, are critical to cracking down on the more frequently occurring types of mass shootings that we experience. I know the other ones get more of the attention, but the ones that happen more frequently and take more lives, focusing on the trafficking can go a long way towards curtailing those.
During the effort to pass the gun dealer licensing bill, I had a fairly constant refrain: somewhere between a legal gun manufacturer and a crime scene, there is someone pretending to be a law-abiding gun owner or gun dealer who is not. There is some break in the legal stream of commerce that puts the guns in the hands of the people who should not have them. That's why we focus on gun dealer licensing. That's why we should be focusing on lost and stolen. I remember debating a lost and stolen gun provision on the floor with Peter Roskam, who left a decade and a half ago for Congress. But I could not understand why people would be opposed to regulating lost and stolen guns until it became obvious to me that that's just the excuse people use after they've been caught. I lost that gun. How do you lose a gun? There's also, a package potentially developing. You mentioned Senator Villivalem's bill on lost and stolen. Senator Ellman has the safe storage bill. The Supreme Court jurisprudence has really bound our hands in some ways in saying that people have a right to protect their homes, to have guns in their homes. That doesn't mean we can't put qualifications on. So sort of a safe home approach. Those two bills fit. I know we're going to be talking about Karina's law at some point here. We have to be. The Supreme Court keeps throwing us surprises, and I will tell you, we were waiting on the Supreme Court's decision in Rahimi, am I saying that right?
Yeah.
And they surprised me in saying that we can, in fact, regulate at that intersection of guns and domestic violence, and we need to. We're unpacking that decision now to figure out how Senator Villanueva's bill can be fashioned to fit very neatly within the Supreme Court's parameters. But I'm relieved that we seem to have some elbow room to move into that space now.
think one of the challenges, right, is just with Karina's bill is how to make sure survivors and law enforcement are safe. And I don't know if that segues to you, but.
Sure. Yeah. And I, for us, in terms of things that are important going forward, the continued budget stability. You have to have the resources to run these programs as well as fund law enforcement. So we appreciate the governor's very steady, consistent budgets that are balanced that support the Illinois State Police. We appreciate the Senate leadership making sure that those things are properly funded as well as in the House every year. That consistency allows us to plan for the future and tackle these problems. That's a core thing. In terms of Karina's law and the essence of that, which is to make sure that someone who's been the subject of an order of protection does not have access to a firearm that they can then use to harm the person who filed the order of protection. I think the firearms restraining order task force that was put in place after Highland Park, that did a lot of great work. And there's many people in this room that I want to thank for the work that they did to bring forward some ideas and some solutions. And I think some of the elements and the room to accomplish what Karina's law is trying to do is in that language there that we have here to provide to everybody to support that conversation. But I definitely think the lost and stolen firearms remains a big gap. It's in case after case after case. You track where the gun is. We use the systems that the Attorney General has provided. We use the systems that the ATF has provided. You see where these guns, the path that they've gone along, and you get to the person who's the last person that had it legally, and they say, well, I don't know, it was lost, it was stolen, and there's no accountability for that, and that is very problematic because that is often the shield that's used for someone who is supplying those guns for criminal activity. These are not guns that are being used to, go out duck hunting, okay? These are crime guns, and this is a gap that still needs to be closed.
I mentioned that we really fashioned, our plan after the 2017 Trace report, but I want to give credit to the Joyce Foundation, who actually recently released research on lost and stolen guns and recommendations for solutions. So just showing that from 2017 to this year, this continues to be a problem and we need to do something about it. So thank you for that, Tim. I have a question. Are we taking any questions from the audience?
Sure.
Yeah.
Dan says yes.
Do you have one? Is there any others?
Okay.
While we're getting them, I'd like to shout out Cordelia Coppelson.
yes. She's the best.
She's trained over 1,500 people, law enforcement officers, prosecutors, and advocates on the firearm restraining orders, which is so critical.
Okay.
Wow. Okay. I don't know how much time we have. How much time do we have, Dan?
We have 7 minutes.
Oh. Wow. Okay. This is from Rhiannon Jimenez from Moms Demand Action. Oftentimes, we hear police talk about the importance of community participation in investigations to assist in solving homicide cases. Can Director Kelly talk about what police are doing to encourage community participation in investigations, as well as what more could be done?
Well, I think that is a constant challenge in every community. And it just really goes back to the most basic principles that we teach at the Illinois State Police Academy, the Peelian principles. They're almost 200 years old. The public are the police and the police are the public. You can't have one without the other. You have to have a dialogue and communication between the two in order to be able to protect public safety. And there is no magic policy that can be passed to encourage that relationship. That's daily work. That's good training. That's persistence. It's leadership. It's, at least for the Illinois State Police, it's adhering to our core values of integrity, service, and pride, and making sure we're treating people respectfully. And I think some of the places where we're doing that kind of work, particularly when it comes to the expressway shootings, as well as a project we have in East St. Louis of the Public Safety Enforcement Group, there's really a huge focus on community engagement, and that helps us clear cases so effectively. But it is not anything you can sometimes... there's no easy answer to it. It's just persistence. It's a commitment to listening to people. It's having the right attitude and working through those complicated situations with patience, compassion, and adherence to the law. And it is very hard work, but we just have to keep at it every day.
And I also have a question about the cold case bill, addressing unsolved homicides. The rate in Chicago is only at 18.6%, and there is some pending legislation. I don't know. Do you want to take that?
Sure. Yeah. Okay. It's a good bill. It's we live in a world of infinite need and finite resources, and we're trying to figure out if there are creative ways to deploy police resources to tackle some of the cold cases. The unfortunate reality is there are way too many hot cases at the same time, and we need to find some balance. But some folks have offered some clever suggestions, and we're exploring those, so very much still on the list of things to consider.
Great. And then we already dealt with Karina's bill, but thank you for submitting that question. We'll end with this one. Given the SCOTUS interpretation of a machine gun as applied to bump stocks, does Illinois assault weapons ban independently prohibit bump stocks?
We prohibited attachments that would transform a gun into essentially a machine gun. Like I said, the Supreme Court keeps surprising us. I'm bracing for an unpleasant surprise on that side, but not giving up hope. I think there is... there's still some common sense to be found in some of those justices.
That's in the Protect Illinois Communities Act, right?
Yeah, I'll leave it to the, since we're still have a journey of litigation. I'll leave it to the future to have a final determination of the reach. But I'll reach back to your previous question on community. Participation, collaboration with police officers, and I want to commend the director. There was a tragic shooting that we learned about in Springfield. We saw by way of the state police's investigation and the Sangamon County's prosecution, their indictment, and the swift implementation of both, consistent with state law that the legislature had passed, calling for an independent investigation. The work that we're doing on constitutional policing feeds into the public trust of law enforcement, and to the extent that a portion of the bill that included the Safety Act also dealt with a decertification of bad police officers. And I see Mitch Davis, who was at the table with us as we had about 25 meetings on that. It was law enforcement led. So these were cops saying, we don't want bad cops. And if that message is sent to the community, we get better collaboration with law enforcement at solving some of these unsolved crimes. But until that is made.
All right, I want to extend my gratitude to the panelists today. I want to thank the City Club for devoting so much time to this very important issue. It was an honor to be with you here today. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen. And thank you, GPAC, Director Kelly, President Harmon, Attorney General Raul. Thank you. These are our leaders. It was clear to me today that well, they are leaders, they are public servants first and foremost, and that they rely so much on the leadership of all of you in the room. Mm-hmm. So hopefully by gathering here today, we help to make things even just a little bit better, so that maybe one gun, maybe a thousand guns are out the street, maybe there's one less family sitting in seats here that have to think about someone that's not with us anymore. So hopefully, thank you for all your efforts thus far to get us to a better place. There's a lot more to go. As I mentioned, City Club is committed to helping continue that conversation. We'll see you next week for those of you who are able to join us on Thursday. Check out our website for all the other programs. Lots of exciting stuff to come. Thank you all for spending a great afternoon with us here at City Club.